Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. Nice to see you. Thank you for coming along to this crisscross panel. I'm David Stewart Davis, naked bagpipe wrestling champion of the Outer Isles, an all-round good egg, and I'm the coordinator on this panel. And rather than me going mumbling through some notes to introduce our illustrious people, I thought it'd be best if they introduce themselves to you. So, on the principle of ladies first, this is Judith Cutler.
This is assuming I'm a lady. I'm the ladies' mud wrestling champion of the Cotswolds. Or at least I'd like to be. I write books mostly featuring strong female protagonists who do all the things on the paper that I would like to do in real life. Or not, actually. I think I'm on this panel because I've started to write a series of historical novels set in 1810, which are slightly Poe-esque.
Fine, thank you. And, and on to Andrew. Andrew Pepper.
I'm Andrew Pepper, and I've written three historical detective novels set in London in the 1820s, 30s, and now into the 1840s, featuring a fairly despicable character called Pike. There's no first name, just Pike. And there we go. The latest one is called Kill Devil in Water, and partly set in Jamaica. And that was obviously a reason to go there and do the research. So there we go.
And thirdly, Declan Hughes.
I'm Declan Hughes. I write a private investigator series set in Dublin. I have no roots whatsoever in the 19th century, apart from the fact that I believe some of my ancestors lived then, and so I'm grateful for them, to them. If you notice a look of panic or a sense of trapped animal in my eyes, it will mean we have been in the 19th century for rather too long. Private investigator series, they're hard-boiled crime novels. Ed Loy is my serious detective, and he cuts a swathe, as we say, through contemporary Ireland, and I try to use the crime novel in that classic hard-boiled tradition to talk about contemporary political and social realities, but also to have some violent fun.
And last but not least, Mr. Giles Brandreth.
Hello, yes, my name is Giles Brandreth. I used to be a Member of Parliament, but I'd like it to be known that I am no longer a Member of Parliament. I would like that to be clear straight away. And when I was a Member of Parliament, can I also make it clear that I dug my own moat? And for what it's worth, my darling wife paid for her own videos. We are here, I think, today having this discussion because there are anniversaries afoot. Edgar Allan Poe, 2 centuries since his birth, 150 years this coming week since the birth of Arthur Conan Doyle. This summer also marks another important anniversary. In August 1889, there was the famous dinner at the Langham Hotel, opposite what is now the BBC in Portland Place in London, where the American publisher, Mr. Stoddart, introduced Oscar Wilde to Arthur Conan Doyle. And the result of that encounter was clearly a memorable evening, according to Conan Doyle's autobiography, published in 1926. But the direct result was persuading Conan Doyle to write a second Sherlock Holmes story. There might not have been a second one had it not been for that dinner. He was persuaded as a result of it. He was commissioned to write The Sign of Four. That was the first result of the dinner. The second result was that Oscar Wilde was also ready to write a story that involved murder. That had been what the commission was about. This, of course, was the year after Jack the Ripper. Murder was in the air. And he was persuaded to write The Picture of Dorian Gray. And 100 or so years later, inspired by that dinner and the unlikely, incongruous friendship as it became between Arthur Conan Doyle and Oscar Wilde, I decided to sit down and write Oscar Wilde and the Candlelight Murders, a traditional murder mystery that begins on the afternoon of that very same day. And unlike Declan, I'm not a contemporary person. I'm not interested in violence except for fun. If I come across as being a little bit Tommy Two Ways, that's merely because I'm a modern conservative. I haven't been living in the last 10 years with all of you. I've been living in the 19th century. It's a wonderful place to live. And I just want you to know that there's no evidence that Gladstone, Rosebery or Disraeli fiddled their expenses, because they had none.
Well, as Giles said, we're here to celebrate, in one sense, the anniversaries of Poe and Doyle. First of all, let me consider this, the history of crime fiction. Where does it start? It's almost an impossible question to answer, because I suppose any story which has a crime in it can be regarded as crime fiction. You can go back way back then to, say, the Bible, Cain and Abel and so forth. But if we narrow down our definitions a little bit and think about where crime, the committing of a crime and then the solving of a crime is the main focus of the story, perhaps we can be a little more precise. It is generally regarded that Edgar Allan Poe is the father of the detective story. And that comes across from the stories that he wrote featuring C. Auguste Dupin, a very strange investigator, a gentleman who only really sort of left his rooms, his rather shabby rooms at night, wearing his tinted glasses, and solved, apparently, unsolvable crimes. The stories were narrated by an unnamed narrator, probably the most famous of the stories is Murders in the Rue Morgue. And I just thought it might be interesting to kickstart things by just reading a short piece from Dorothy L. Sayers in her Omnibus of Crime, what she says about that particular story, which is typical of the Auguste Dupin stories. She says, "The story features a combination of three typical motifs. The wrongly suspected man, to whom all the superficial evidence points, the hermetically sealed death chamber, and finally, the solution by unexpected means. In addition, we have Dupin, that's the detective, drawing deductions which the police have overlooked and discovering clues which the police had not thought of looking for. In this story also are enunciated for the first time those two great aphorisms of detective science. First, that when you have eliminated the possible, whatever remains, when you have eliminated all the possibilities, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And secondly, that the more outre a case may appear, the easier it is to solve. Indeed, to take it all round," she says, "the Murders in the Rue Morgue constitutes in itself almost a complete manual of detective theory and practice." Now, for my mind, reading Poe today, I find it hard work. I think his loquaciousness, in a way, gets in the way of the story. They're very interesting sort of puzzles and so forth, but as drama, as an excitement, I think they're lacking. And it was, to my mind, some years later when Arthur Conan Doyle picked up the baton that Poe had left him, that he then, when he created Sherlock Holmes, injected something new into the format. There is drama, there's excitement, there's thrills, and there's atmosphere in the Sherlock Holmes stories. And of course we get the narrator again, but we now have a rounded figure in Dr. Watson. I just wondered what the panel felt about Poe and Doyle now as storytellers. Would anyone like to pick up that point?
I mean, I find him, Poe, certainly a deeply strange, deeply unsettling, you know, figure to read in that sense. And I suppose, you know, kind of what was most memorable for me when reading Poe is not necessarily the solutions that he gives us to the stories, but it's the scenes of kind of horror themselves that sort of, you know, kind of last well beyond the sort of solutions. And it's that sort of, you know, the kind of image of the body being torn apart in the Murders of the Rue Morgue, or the man and the man of the crowd who kind of, you know, refuses to be interpreted. And it's that sense of something kind of strange, something kind of unsettling, something that can't be read, something that can't be understood. And I suppose I see sort of, you know, Dupin as something of a voyeur as well, a kind of a contemporary sort of peeping Tom in a sense, which makes him a kind of, you know, sort of someone who's very, very difficult to kind of identify with. And I think he takes sort of, you know, that idea of kind of character, sort of detective fiction, almost to the point of collapse, I think. And I think, you know, these days probably he wouldn't be published because no one would know what to do with him. So in that sense, you know, kind of, I think he's brilliant. I think he's much, much more interesting than Doyle in a way. But
Judith, you've done some work on Poe. You've written about Poe. Where do you come on this?
Poe owes me a great deal, not the other way around. When I was a youthful 20, I'd had to do a dissertation on Poe for my honours degree. And although before I went to university, I had been regularly published and indeed won prizes, after reading Poe and his sort of successor in the pompoverbosity and verbopomposity front, Henry James, I couldn't write a word for years and years and years. All these lovely words like ratiocination. You see, I can pronounce it.
I could never pronounce that.
And you've got the bells, the tintinabulation of the bells. They done my head in, ladies and gentlemen. And as a consequence, literally, until I reached the age of about 35, I couldn't put pen usefully to paper to write anything that was creative. Oh, I was fine on essays and ratiocination and all the rest of it, but he really destroyed my style. And I still have one major problem with him, that I still don't understand how the orangutan got the body upside down in the chimney. So not only did he destroy my writing career for a long time, he's destroyed my belief in detectives, and especially in orangutans. So I have problems with Poe. I don't have problems with Sherlock Holmes, but truly Poe is damned peculiar. I don't know what he was on at the time. I don't think we should inquire, but as I think Berlioz was probably on the same stuff, really. Truly, I wanted to reread everything, and I wanted to reread my thesis for this, and the reader, I gave up. I'm sorry. But he owes me, remember that.
Giles, what about this claim that Andrew makes about Poe being a much more interesting writer than...
Poe is a much more interesting character, in a sense, to write a biography of, because, and in a way... What Judith has just said encapsulates the essence. If we're talking about two extraordinary lives, you know, Poe's life is an extraordinary phenomenon. We do know what he was on. He was on drink, essentially. I've been on Poe pilgrimages. I spent a lot of time in Baltimore, went to the house where he lived. He's a fascinating, dangerous character. You do not want to meet him. You want to know about him. He would be awful. He's stumbling about. He's got money problems. He's got women problems. He's got parent problems. He's got extraordinary alcohol problems. He has got an amazing imagination. He is angry with the world. He is doing this against the clock. He's trying to write the book. He doesn't really care about the book. He's contemptuous of himself. He knows that he isn't loved. He wants to be loved. He's losing weight. He's drinking more. It's all a complete shambles and a mess. He is a human mess. He comes in here. He's half dressed. You know he's a genius. You know some of the lines are great. We remember the Raven. But oh, please, don't come in. But here comes Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Oh, what a relief. A good and great man comes into the room, we feel sure of where we are with him.
Until he gets his Ouija board out.
No! Funnily enough, even on that, he is such a good man. I believe in fairies entirely because he did. But the point is, Poe is our wayward John the Baptist. Conan Doyle is our Messiah. They reflect their different personalities. But one did, I think, help the other. I don't think either of them, curiously, I mean, I think probably we would say that Poe is the greater writer in terms of exactly the phrases that come to mind, the tintinabulation of the bells and all of that. You can read his poetry, and there are wonderful flashes of amazing writing, which you don't really find in... Conan Doyle, who is a wonderful human being, a great storyteller, and somebody with an extraordinary imagination who will be remembered forever because he simply created the most famous fictional character in the history of humanity. Oh, that's something to have done, isn't it?
Declan, where do you come in on this?
I go some way along with Andrew in terms of Poe. I think the Dupin stories, although they are, strictly speaking, the first detective stories, the maybe the legacy of Poe works more for the modern crime writer through the more the darker stories, the stories of horror, because that Poe captures something inchoate, undefinable, but absolutely and incredibly powerful. It's hard to go back to Poe. It's like Shelley, or you know, there are certain things, certain writers you read in your youth, and it is difficult to recapture them. I read Poe as a young teenager and thought it was extraordinary. Thought he was, yes, absolutely magical. He said everything, but I didn't want to go back there. I think there's a nice point about Poe in terms of realism. You'll hear on panels like this, particularly the writers of police procedurals, dismiss the writers of other subgenres, such as the private investigator, because their stories are fantastical, whereas police procedural writers are writing documentaries. And I think it's always good to remember that Poe wrote the first detective stories before there were police forces in France or in England. So, you know, should we be chasing the reality, or should the reality be chasing us? I think that's a good point to focus on with Poe. Conan Doyle is Conan Doyle. I mean, he wrote the book. He was the Louis Armstrong of our genre. There were predecessors, but everybody remembers him as the true first. Right. And you know, you get that honor because you earn it.
Daniel Stashar has written two biographies, one of Poe, which is a sort of biography, and one of Conan Doyle, both of which, if people don't know these books, are to be recommended. I mean, the Conan Doyle is just a wonderful, wonderful read of the life of a great and fundamentally good man, a decent man. You know, when I think of my murder mysteries, I would like to write like Oscar Wilde, but I'd like to be like Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, what a fundamentally good person. But Stashar gets to the heart of the dark imagination of Poe. So if you want to explore the dark imagination, go to Poe. But if you want, as it were, the bedrock of traditional English, though he was Scottish, traditional British murder mystery, you go to Conan Doyle.
Holmes is a darker figure than I think you're portraying him there.
Conan Doyle is a straight man. I haven't said anything about Holmes. Yeah. Holmes, of course, is a flawed hero. Yeah, otherwise, he wouldn't be a hero. That's why we love him. Yeah. My God, I've got my syringe with me. I'm a little bit brighter than you this morning because I am on drugs.
I was on drugs last night.
Yeah, exactly. That's the difference. Yeah. That's how you end your day. That's how I start mine.
But I suppose what's interesting about Doyle, Holmes certainly, is one never knows, you know, why he's doing what he's doing. One can never quite pin him down in that sense. You know, it's either an intellectual challenge, it's the affairs of the state, it's you know, kind of taking on professional gangs, it's money, you know, and it's all these things kind of, you know, mixed up, and you never get sort of, you know, kind of Doyle actually saying, this is why Holmes is doing what he's doing. And so it's left for us to kind of wonder, in a sense. And in that, he's quite a sort of, you know, unsettling. I mean, it's not quite sort of, you know, the comfortable, reassuring sort of read, I think, that sort of, you know, perhaps, you know, kind of some people might associate.
I think that's very good, because you never think Sherlock Holmes has a job. You know, it's not he's not a professional detective, although he does take money at certain stages, and I think it evolved that way. But effectively, yes, absolutely.
He calls himself a consulting detective. But yeah. I think one of the, I don't know whether it was a, you can never be sure, but it was a deliberate thing with Doyle, that I always think when he created Sherlock Holmes, he did it almost like the painting by numbers sort of things you used to be able to get, where you had to colour it in black, and it left several spaces vacant, so that the reader could fill in those for himself, and therefore create something special for the reader. But also, it's allowed the character to live for so long. We're getting a film at the end of the show, aren't we, with Robert Downey Jr. And they're supposed to be doing something different with Sherlock Holmes. Probably not, but they're filling in those gaps that Doyle left, and I think he. Whether, as I say, it was a deliberate ploy on his part, or whether it just happened that way. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why the character survives, because we're able to add our own little touch to that dark character.
Is there a danger in producing a character which other people can take up and run with? Now, I know you're an expert at the... I mean, I'm not knocking your expertise, but no. if when I die, I suppose I will one day, somebody takes one of my detectives and run with it. I would be really miffed. I would send a Poe and Thunderbolt and do them in because they are mine. How do people feel about this idea of pastiching? A really tremendous and individual writer.
Well, this gets to what the university. This is what the university people call the death of the author. And the truth is that Sherlock Holmes now belongs to the world. And David and I did a radio program the other day about this group of people who in the 1890s created these amazing mythic characters. Obviously Sherlock Holmes, but Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Peter Pan. These figures created in this period, Oscar Wilde created a myth of himself, that then, as it were, belong outside the literature. And Sherlock Holmes is known across the world by people who have never read a word, and in a sense don't need to. And I think we just have to accept that the myth was created, gene laid out of the bottle. To start looking at whether he was trying to do this deliberately, I think is a mistake, because we know that when he was a young doctor, age 26, 27, doing this, he was in Southsea, he was trying to earn a living as a GP, he was just writing a story. It was one of a slew of material that he was putting out into the world. He wasn't thinking, I'm painting by numbers here, I must create 5 out of the 7 characteristics. If I have 5, then there'll be 2 for the myths and...
Not necessarily deliberate, but it would just happen that way.
So he didn't even want to continue writing his own
He didn't want to run with his own character.
He wanted to stop, yeah.
He wanted to move on.
Decker, you write a private eye.
Yes.
And I think of all the characters here, that fits in with the... both Dupin and with Holmes, in the sense that people come to them and say, I have a problem, can you solve it? Has Doyle or the Sherlock Holmes myth or the Sherlock Holmes idea influenced your work, or have you actually tried to avoid any kind of connection with that?
I think probably the big evolution in the crime story. You can see the golden age in a line from Holmes. There are various it's pretty straightforward. Whereas I write from a hardboiled tradition, which involves effectively a professional detective who needs the job and who does it for the money. Now he may have other issues. He may have a mission. He may have a cause. He may be a very good man. He may have, in the Dashiell Hammett formulation, a code, although you're never quite sure what that code is. It is not as highfalutin as Philip Marlowe set it out, Raymond Chandler set it out, down these mean streets a man must go who is not himself mean. I think that is the big development as I see it. Occasionally my frustration or unease, not just with the Holmes stories, but also with modern detectives, is when you feel they are doing it just to fulfill either the writer and reader's expectations that there must be a mystery and it must be solved, but also that they appear to have no other needs in life. They don't need to earn a living.
Peter Wimsey sort of stuff.
Well, exactly, yes. The independent means or the gentleman detective.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think Holmes straddles those too. But actually, when you go back and read the stories, they're tougher and harder than that all the time. Mm. And because he is himself such a kind of flinty character. But I would say that's the biggest evolution in terms of how the kind of mythic PI moved into the 20th century and has come through. Although, you get in Holmes also a sense of, post-colonial blowback. You get things that are quite modern and quite unusual when you go back and read the stories that we think today, we're dealing with social and political issues. No one else knew about that stuff, but Holmes does it. There are, people bring home import diseases or strange connections from the colonies, and they come back to haunt the characters in the stories. And I think that's a very potent aspect. And also, as I say, the Gothic, which Doyle was still very closely connected to, above all for me with Poe, but also with Doyle, the atmosphere, that Gothic atmosphere, that sense of claustrophobic unease is haunting and permeates what I would describe, you know, I think permeates noir fiction. Noir fiction comes in a line part of its germination is the Gothic.
I put another author in here that we haven't mentioned so far? Charlotte Bronte. Mm-hmm. If you think of The Woman in the Attic.
Absolutely.
Also in the Gothic tradition, obviously the great romance, and we married him. Mm-hmm. But I think we should bring in other people into this equation as well. Mm-hmm. And I think Charlotte should be one of them.
Sure. I mean, I think sort of, you know, what links Poe and Doyle is they're both detectives and not necessarily interested in the law. You know, the law is a sort of something that in some ways sort of needs to be respected. The law is necessary in order for society to kind of function. But they're not doing it really to kind of uphold the law in a sense. And I think sort of, you know, what happens in the 20th century is that the law in these stories is not necessarily a kind of a force for bad in a sense. And what happens in the 20th century is the law becomes a means by which kind of corruption is sort of permeated in a sense. And I don't think kind of neither Poe nor Doyle go that far. So they don't kind of show institutions like the police or the kind of law to be itself corrupt. But I think that's where kind of crime fiction goes in the 20th century.
Holmes is certainly a law unto himself. In several cases, he overrides the
But I think the other thing is that sort of the other place that they don't go, where sort of, you know, figures like kind of Hammett go, certainly in the sort of 20th century, is their detectives are not complicit in, you know, kind of what they investigate. They somehow stand apart from it, stand aloof from it. And I think what you find in the 20th century, and this is where perhaps, you know, sort of, you know, I would see sort of, you know, my character, who I've created a more of a sort of 20th century figure rather than, you know, someone who fits into easily to a 19th century sort of, you know, setting, is that they're sort of somehow kind of complicit in the things that are wrong with what they're investigating, and that produces in them all kinds of kind of anxieties that I don't think you find in Dupin or Conan Doyle or Sherlock Holmes in a sense. So I think sort of, you know, one can trace sort of these kind of lineages back and forth.
Yeah.
In terms of other authors, I think sort of, you know, kind of, you know, I would sort of extend the birth of detective fiction or crime fiction a little bit earlier into the 18th century with Godwin and Caleb Williams, and even perhaps further still back to Daniel Defoe and him writing about Jonathan Wilde. Mm. And Jonathan Wilde, who's both a sort of, you know, kind of a police figure and a gangster at the same time, and he would be, the person I would be most influenced by.
I think the drawback with those is in the sense that they were standalone, so they didn't have the time to roll on and catch up the public imagination. Do anybody on the panel use your characters, do they have those leaps of imagination, you know, where Holmes makes the deduction or Dupin makes the deduction, and see something, as Dorothy Arcer says, that the police don't see? Do you use those, dare I say, tricks?
I do it, even in police procedurals, because I think a good police procedural isn't just A, B, C. And I don't think good police officers just do A, B, C. I think a good police officer on the page or in real life actually has to make that leap of the imagination to... Obviously, we've got DNA, we've got street cameras, we've got every damn thing now. But certainly, years ago, you had to think out of the box. Otherwise, you couldn't have done it.
Mm. I mean, I'm happier in the 19th century for a variety of reasons. One of them is the simple one of not having to deal with all the things like DNA, sophisticated fingerprinting, because I'm interested, as it were, in people, humanity, the heart, rather than the mechanics of it. That is one reason. I also, one of the reasons I picked on Oscar Wilde as being a detective is he does fit into this idea of the loner, the maverick, the individual. The person who is both heroic and at the same time flawed is compelling and attractive, and yet you're drawn in it. You wouldn't quite dare do what he dares to do. As Saki said, the best kind of social behaviour is to go as far as you possibly can and then be brave enough not to stop. Well, Oscar Wilde was capable of that, and indeed Sherlock Holmes was as well. And the reason that I'm happy with somebody like Oscar Wilde as the detective is two reasons, really. One, that in the beginning of Scotland Yard, we were in such a class stratified society that if you look at the case of the time, when Scotland Yard was trying to investigate, as it were, murders, even among the upper middle class, certainly within the aristocracy, they literally had to go and make appointments with the butler. They had to go to the servants' entrance because they were not gentlemen. whereas somebody like Oscar Wilde could literally walk up to the front door. And also, being an Irishman, he's an outsider. So I like a detective who's an outsider and who has access. And I think a detective who has a poetic imagination, because that's what it's got to be about. Fundamentally, people want to read these books, whatever they're, modern or, because it's about human beings. And we want the human instinct to play a part. The reason so many of these things are often called about, you know, it's called Morse because we're fascinated by Morse as a human being. Sherlock Holmes as a human being. So I like the idea of Oscar Wilde as a human being and being a poet as well, and a great talker but also a great listener, being able to make the leap, the imaginative leap.
But the reason why Sherlock Holmes is able to solve crimes is not necessarily because he makes these kind of wild leaps of the imagination. It's because he knows so much, in a sense. So it's the sort of, you know, the cataloguing of all kinds of sort of information about sort of, you know, everything to do with the world. So it's that kind of knowledge, in a sense, that he kind of, you know, kind of carries with him that enables him to do what he's doing, in a sense. And this is why I think he's probably the sort of, you know, the kind of forerunner of, you know, CID, the sort of, you know, the kind of categorizing of sort of, you know, he has the sort of encyclopedia of criminals, you know. So I think he sort of stands at sort of the forefront of that particular.
So that makes him a very modern character, then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, on one level, on another level, it makes him faintly absurd. I mean, I think, and as it went on down the line, I mean, SS Van Dyne's character Philip Vance, who knew everything about everything, and of whom Ogden Nash memorably said, Philo Vance needs a kick in the pants. He was an insufferable polymath. And there is that about Holmes, that kind of, you know, man of, you know, the Uberman. He is the great man. So there's a sort of creepy aspect to that. The tradition I work in, somebody said of Hammett, Hammett revolutionized the detective novel by taking the detection out of it.
Right.
And that the hard-boiled detective doesn't ratiocinate. Woo! At 45. I thank you. Repeat performance in the bar. he leads with his chin. He says, it was probably him. There was a sense of, we all know who did that. You know, it was that guy, and even that he did it, that gang boss, the reason that body was in the alley was because of that gang, but the gang was because of the political state in this town, and the political state in this town was because of the corruption in this country. So it's a complete web. The crime itself is a symptom. So what happens in that kind of evolution of the genre is that it is no longer just about one dead body. It's about a whole web of corruption that permeates through the society. So that's where the detective came, and it almost had to devolve into that. I mean, there's an interesting, because the absurd inheritor of the Holmes tradition of the Superman is the criminal profiler. And that entire subgenre, the criminal profile. It is the most bizarre tradition in crime fiction. Here, you set up a mystery. You could all write one tomorrow. You set up a mystery, and anyone can do that, and the police can't solve it, as they often can't. And then you get this guy or this woman who's a criminal profiler. You've got to mention Quantico frequently, because that's very important. Quantico, Quantico, Quantico. And what do? They come in and they think of the murderer. That's it. They think of it. They think of him. They'll go, he's this, he's that, he's short, he's angry, he wears a beige suit, and he's wandering around a provincial town in, you know, it's snake oil salesmanship on an extraordinary level. How these books have sold in such numbers, it bewilders me. Check out Malcolm Gladwell has a great article in the New Yorker about a year ago on criminal profiling and how it is effectively a load of old nonsense. And he goes through actual FBI profilers, how the BTK, have I got that right? Bound, gagged and tied. This serial killer in the States. Back in 82, the FBI issued a profile which encompassed absolutely any. He was either married or he wasn't. He was either a young man married to an older woman or an older man with a younger wife. He was either black or white.
Don't forget the double-breasted suit.
So in that sense, it's become the criminal profile could be subgenre can be seen as a burlesque of the Holmesian tradition. You know,
that's an interesting theory, yeah. Judith. You were wanting to say something in connection with that.
It's been said.
All right, and Giles.
Well, all I wanted to say, of course, is the reasons these things sell is the people. It's the reason people go to magic shows. People know that when they see a magician sawing the lady in half, a lady is not being sawed in half, but they still like to see it done. They know that this is irrational. I just say the word irrational to make you realise that traditionally we say ratiocination.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much.
With a song, I mean, I don't know, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't say it that often. Certainly not since the new teeth arrived.
As an Irishman, I'm obviously always glad to be corrected by an Englishman.
That's okay. But it's only the Irish who really speak good English anyway.
The magic show premise can be found in the Agatha Christie novels too, can't it? You know, Poirot is in the same tradition, yeah, as getting all the suspects together at the end of the novel.
But Christie lays the clues out for you. I mean, yeah. Christie plays fair.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's worth... If we're talking about the inheritance that we have from the 19th century, it's worth remembering that both Edgar Allan Poe and Conan Doyle were great enthusiasts for the theatre. Edgar Allan Poe worked briefly as an actor, was very enamoured of the theatre and indeed of actresses. Conan Doyle wrote plays. Conan Doyle, through Oscar Wilde and other people that he knew, became involved in the circle of Sir Henry Irving. The great big hero in English letters and arts in the 19th century was Sir Henry Irving. He was the giant, and he was the great magic man of the theatre. People now say that, you know, he had a stammer, he had this North Country accent, he walked with a strange gait. Some people say, was he a mesmerist? How did he command a theatre with 3,000 people without microphones? How did he do it? Well, there was a magic about it. And the Victorian theatre... So I think that these people, in a sense, what they're doing, what Christie is doing, as it were, following the same tradition, is they're almost setting out a play for us. Christie was a playwright too. Mm-hmm. They bring us our cast of characters, our scenes, they have their hero who makes an entrance, who has the aphorisms and the mannerisms of a hero, and at the end brings the whole thing together. And I think that is partly an inheritance of Victorian theatre, Conan Doyle...
Well, I certainly know that, you know, Doyle, when he was at school, was taken to see Hamlet with Irving. You know that Irving is possibly Dracula as well as Sherlock Holmes. He was so inspired. Mm. Can I just turn the conversation in another direction, particularly for the three people who actually write period mysteries? Because in a strange way, period mysteries are making a comeback, or historical mysteries. When Doyle and Poe were writing, they were obviously writing for a contemporary audience, so they didn't have to put too much period detail into their stories. It spoke for itself. That has to change with a modern writer. How do you do that without overburdening the reader with too much detail? Giles, I mean, I've read some of your books, and they wonderfully capture that period that Oscar Wilde was in. And
what's interesting to me is that, of course, we impose on Conan Doyle the nostalgia. He is writing a contemporary story.
Yeah.
It's us who bring this nostalgic feel to it.
Yeah.
It's because I think we associate Sherlock Holmes with our childhoods. There's something cosy and comforting about it. Mm. I mean, I was brought up in Baker Street. I lived in Baker Street. In a block of flats called Chiltern Court. Arnold Bennett died in this block of flats and lived in this block of flats. Huey Green, do you remember Huey Green? Huey Green lived in the flat next door. Yeah? Yeah, if opportunity had knocked at a different door, who knows, I might have been Peaches Geldof's great uncle. Anyway, for me, what I wanted to do, the pleasure for me in my writing of these books is actually, and when I read a historical novel, is I want to feel that everything I read about is real, is true, is accurate. I'm accepting the premise that there is, as it were, going to be a story, but I want to know that everything you learn about Oscar Wilde, or indeed Conan Doyle, or my narrator, a man called Robert Sherard, is actually true. I want these people to have been in those places on the day that I said they were. And for me, the satisfaction, the enjoyment as a writer of getting into this world is taking the journey with them. And I came to this because I'd been writing non-fiction for a while, And I was asked to write a biography and offered a lot of money of Diana, Princess of Wales. And I thought, oh, God, I don't want to do that, even for all the money. And my wife said, who do you want to write about? Your great hero is Oscar Wilde. Do you want to write it? And I thought, well, it's people have written biographies. And I thought, I can do a serial biography. And then this... And so actually what I'm doing is trying to create... And if you're going to write about people, you want to walk with them and talk with them, you've got to fall a little in love with them. And I have fallen in love with both the period and the people. And for me, it is a matter of honor to get the facts absolutely right. You know, what they ate, what they drank, where they were. I want to know, yes, yes, he's got it right.
Mm-hmm. Judith, what about you?
I think I did it the other way around. I fell in love with the Regency period, about which I write, when I was younger than when I got destroyed by Edgar Allan Poe. I think if I had another existence, it would have been in the time of Georgette Heyer's characters, not Jane Austen's, because I couldn't write like her. Not, though, at the bosom-heaving end of the market. I would have been the girl who goes down the back stairs carrying stuff that you don't want to talk about just after breakfast. But I have, over a long, many, many years, absorbed all the detail about these characters. And when somebody said to me, write a short story set in Regency times, I know that they expected a bosom to heave and an eyelash to flutter and a fan to fall to the floor. So I thought, bother this, I won't do that. I will go for a character who is mobile, who is actually noble, so he can go up to the front door, who has friends who will let him into the back door. That's why I chose a parish priest. Once you've got all this love in your heart for a period, I hope you select the right details, because you don't want your books to look like a textbook of history. Little footnote here, they did actually call this item this. Do believe it, won't you? Because it really does spoil it, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
You need the mores, you need to know that a woman in my period and in yours, if she's a lady, can't go about unattended. And it has to be a given. As soon as you start pointing these out, Lady X had to call her trusty serving maid, and then they could go down to the church. It doesn't work at all. You've got to do it as naturally as if it eats and breathes. Can I put in a parenthesis?
Yes, certainly.
I am writing mostly contemporary fiction, but the most suddenly writing about 1810 frees up the Gothic in me. And there is more unpleasantness behind these elegant Georgian doors, Regency doors, than there will ever be in the 20s and the noughties. I don't know why. Is it the dresses? Is it something lurking in the wind? Is it the water? But certainly going back into that period, it becomes Gothic. Weird.
Andrew, what about yourself?
Well, I think there's a difference between sort of authenticity and accuracy. And sort of while you want maybe to be sort of, you know, kind of authentically sort of true as you possibly can to the particular kind of period that you're writing in, so you don't want kind of, you know, writing a novel set in the 1830s, people talking on mobile phones. But sort of, you know, kind of beyond that, you know, I don't think one can ever be sort of, you know, kind of accurate, you know, about kind of recreating this. I think sort of anyway, the detective sort of fiction formula is to some extent a sort of, you know, late 19th century, 20th century sort of invention. So then for me to write about the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, you know, about sort of detection, it's an anachronism in a sense. Mm-hmm. It's something that perhaps wouldn't have existed in the way that, you know, I write those stories. So there's nothing necessarily accurate about it. But at the same time, if people don't kind of believe in what you're trying to do, if they don't believe in the sense of place you're trying to give, if they don't believe in the character in that sense, then they're not going to go along with it.
Would you say you rely to some extent on your reader's knowledge of the period anyway, and they've seen the films, they've seen, they've read other books, and you allow them to have some sort of knowledge without spelling it all out.
But that's the case with all kind of good writing, yeah. You know, good crime writing. I mean, there's sort of, you know, to take a sort of example of something done very badly, think about the kind of Da Vinci Code, where sort of, you know, suddenly you get the kind of, you know, the chunk of, you know, kind of either explicatory dialogue or the descriptions of Paris, which kind of lifted from the Fromer's Guide, sort of, you know, kind of, you know, bolted onto the text, and you're sort of reading it, and it's very, very jarring. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of, you know, you have to do a lot of research, you have to kind of read about these things, but yeah, you want to kind of wear that as lightly as you possibly can, because otherwise it's just going to seem, you know, kind of jarring, I suppose. And it's getting that sort of detail in without drawing attention to the fact that that's what you're doing that's important. I suppose maybe that's what Giles, that you were talking about.
The first rule is to create a good mystery. If that is the contract with the... There's a contract with the reader, I think. And it's the publisher partly supplies it by the design of the book, the feel of the book. You know what you are buying. And the contract with my book is that you are buying a traditional murder mystery. So people will expect clues. They will expect, as it were, to be playing the game. So you've got to do all of that. And then you've also got to create the world that rings true. And I found the truest way to make it ring true is that it actually is true. I also have the advantage in my world that because I've chosen a real figure, though a mythic figure in the shape of Oscar Wilde as my protagonist, people already know him. If I told you that Oscar Wilde was walking in the back door, if I told you that now, and you knew that the man was alive, every one of you would look. You have to look. If Oscar Wilde comes into a room, you have to look. And that is true of people all over the world. Now, there is, if you take a real person, therefore a responsibility to try to be true to that person. I'm exploiting Oscar Wilde. But he knew that he would be, and I think was quite pleased at the idea. And he, you know, filched lots of material from other people himself. So I mean, he was into the game completely. But I'm not only got to get the period right, but I've also got to get the man right, his wife right, his children right. I feel a responsibility. But that also is the satisfaction of being a writer.
Yeah. But you can't libel someone in the 19th century, which is good.
No.
There we go.
In your conscience. It's
nice. Declan was saying that he writes contemporary PI because he wants to touch on modern issues in his novels. Do you think that can you touch on, certainly you can touch on moral issues, but can you touch on sort of modern issues in a period novel? In what way?
Well, I think kind of good novels are sort of based around sort of particular themes. So they're both about kind of, you know, kind of mystery, the murder mystery, sort of, you know, and then kind of who and why and so on. So they're kind of, you know, the kind of psychology. But they've got to sort of, you know, kind of tell, I think, a bigger story about sort of, you know, kind of social and political events in a sense. So, right. You know,
that can have resonances for today.
That's right. But, yeah. You know, sort of if you're writing about sort of, you know, kind of religious or sectarianism in the sort of, you know, 19th century, then obviously that speaks, you know, in all kinds of ways about sort of, you know, our more contemporary situation. If you're writing about kind of corruption with institutions, if you're writing about sort of, you know, kind of poverty and, you know, inequality, you know, social inequality, all of these things have resonances sort of now.
Yeah.
They have to be kind of true to what you're doing in the 19th century, but they speak about kind of, you know, contemporary concerns just
as
well.
It may seem an obvious thing to say, but we write of our time. If you see a film set in the 19th century but made in the 60s, it's very different from a film set in exactly the same period but made in the 80s.
Yeah.
For all sorts of reasons, some conscious, many unconscious, just because the people we are at different times. And even writing contemporary fiction, you bring the issues of those days to bear on it in ways you can't help. So you're, you know, there's the relationship with period is more complicated, perhaps, than straightforward. Here I am in the modern world, we all know what that's like, but look at the glorious 19th or 18th or 17th century, because it's a refuge.
Yes.
I mean, the past is not the past, yeah. You know, it lives.
These things only work... Forgive me, Judith.
I have this problem that everybody sees the Regency and Georgian periods as times of great affluence and culture and elegance, but if you just lift the skirting board, and you see cockroaches. It was kind of enormous poverty. Think of enclosures, think of starvation, some of the wettest winters we had, the corners. People are literally starving while the Brighton Pavilion is being brought. And that's the side that I love writing about. And I actually probably know more about poverty then than I do now. But it's a nice play for me, because people expect grandeur and wonders, and they get...
So you're illuminating the dark corners. Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to think so.
one of the most interesting series being written today is by Andrew Taylor's Lydmouth novels, and they're set in a border town, Welsh border town, or English border town after the war. And in a way, what they do is they revisit the classic Golden Age stories, but expose all the stuff that the Golden Age writers consciously or unconsciously kept out. So all the nasty, the racism, the class snobbery, the sexual secrets, etc., are explored and looked at, and not in a kind of with relish, not in a sort of missionary way, but so it's a very interesting excavation of the genre, that's a really creative way in which period can be re-explored within the genre.
But do you think that's more sort of, you know, that's trying to sort of, you know, strip back something that might have existed at the time, so it's being true to the place?
Oh,
Does that say something more about kind of where we are now?
No, I don't think it's loading. They seem to me, although, again, I didn't live in a border town after the war, so but they seem to me very accurate. It's not a sort of TV movie version where you just let's get loads of sex and violence into this, because frankly it was a bit dull back then, you know. They are restrained as well, so
settings vary, but people stay fundamentally the same. I mean, that's why people still go to see Shakespeare plays, because there's something resonating there on the stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jane Austen is a contemporary writer. We are still reading all these great Victorians, the Brontes, Trollope, Thackeray, Dickens, because actually what they're about speaks to us now.
When you strip away the period.
The one name we haven't mentioned so far from the 1890s, who I think has affected the way we view ourselves and the way we tell our stories, is that of Freud. The spirit, though Arthur Conan Doyle as a human being lived beyond Freud, he was writing before Freud, he is a contemporary of Freud, Conan Doyle. What Freud does is he, as it were, gives us permission to look at things in a way that we weren't able to look at them before. So he's given us a license to look at things. But basic humanity hasn't changed. And I think
thinking about sort of, you know, kind of Poe could have created Freud in a way, in a sense, so kind of to bring us back to sort of, you know, Poe in terms of sort of, you know, kind of that.
But is there a story of this? Could we have them setting out together to solve a murder?
Exactly.
I want to just draw this to a conclusion by throwing it open to Barry Stubbard.
Something that Judith and Giles both touched on, so the characters of Poe, the characters of Poe and Conan Doyle. We forgive Poe being dissipated and feckless and his whole character. There's kind of romanticism about that. Doyle was taken in by a simple hoax, the fairies at the bottom of the garden. Do we forgive him that?
Totally. Totally. I mean, we forgive Poe because we may be romantic about it, but we're very sympathetic to poor Mrs. Poe. Oh, and all, everybody who knew him, the people who lent him money, the editors he never delivered to, he was a nightmare. Edgar Allan Poe was a nightmare. Fortunately, he created a living nightmare that we can still enjoy.
Keith.
He was a paedophile too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, one for my dear wife, could I please have my complete Edgar Allan Poe back? Second question, is Sherlock Holmes just a disinterested puzzle solver, or does he have a moral code?
Oh, he certainly has a moral...
First question.
Sorry.
Yes. You can have it back if you promise to read it all.
Oh, certainly. I mean, various stories in which he appears. He shows his moral strength in going beyond the law. I'm thinking about the Boscombe Valley mystery and, the one that's in Devon. And the Blue Carbuncle too, where he lets the people go because that's the best thing for them rather than putting them in jail. Would you not agree, Giles?
I think he has the moral code that Conan Doyle would like to have had, to have dared to have himself. Conan Doyle was a very conventional person. You know, he had the values of a traditional army officer, etc., gentleman of his era. But in his head, I think he was a slightly more dangerous person. He was a more adventurous spirit. And I think he allows Holmes to be more of an individual.
I mean, I think the stories have a code, a moral code, but I don't think he does. I don't think kind of Sherlock Holmes has a moral code. I don't think he's necessarily concerned about these things in the same way that I don't think he's concerned about the law. I think there are other things kind of going on in terms of why he does what he does, and that's...
I think he's aware that, you know, man-made law is very, very fragile. You look at what you could be arrested for 100 years ago, and now it doesn't matter at all. And I think he's well aware of that in his treatment of the criminals that he lets go. Yeah. Have we... Yeah.
Can you just talk about Wilkie Collins? I love Wilkie.
Yes. Ah.
Thoughts on Wilkie Collins?
Yeah.
Woman in White.
Yeah, well, we saw the show. Oh.
I directed a production of The Woman in White. Count Fosco had 6 live mice, and then one of them died. That was an interesting night.
Well, of course,
it's broken back for the stage. You don't have a climax, so we ended up with a magnificent sword fight between Walter Hartwright and Count Fosco to round it out, because it kind of it dwindles as a narrative.
Yeah. Did you get the mice on the stage? Yeah, the mice.
Fosco had the mice.
In the Moonshot, of course, you've got Sergeant Cuff, who is yet another, along with Inspector Bucket from Bleak House, is another sort of detective who is starting the procedure that will lead up to Sherlock Holmes, I think. And again, he's a canny man, sort of laid back, but that word I can't pronounce, ratiocinia, I mean, whatever. another model, I think, probably for Conan Doyle.
And he's got the quirks, he likes his roses.
That's right, yeah.
But I suppose what you get in Collins is a much broader sort of social picture that sort of, you know, kind of perhaps, you know, links back to sort of, you know, Eliot in Middlemarch, you know, and so they're not necessarily just sort of stories of crime and detection. You get a kind of a portrait of the whole of society sort of told through the sort of, you know...
And women are included here in this very, very masculine world. They have an importance.
Yes, the thing about the Moonstone, I think it's very interesting, it's a complete full Victorian novel with this fascinating story. And then, of course, you get Golden Age fiction, which is criticised for not being the proper novel. But there, and in a way, we've expanded the detective story again, so it is. But right at the beginning, you get a fantastic novel like the Moonstone. Mm.
Any other questions? Yes.
I'm rather fascinated by the potential for conflict in the number of writers who have used both Conan Doyle and Poe as their fictional, as their detective. Because there are at least half a dozen people using Poe.
Yes.
And there are at least half a dozen people using Doyle. And yet, when you actually look at them, take Doyle, for example, you've got two writers who look at Mr. Bell and have him assisting him. You've got a couple of writers in the sort of 1890s. There's an American lady who has him working with Lewis Carroll. Then you have several people in the 1920s where he's with Houdini. Isn't that interesting, the way people have spread themselves out?
In America, there are an awful lot of Poe as detective. He's a lovely man in those books, isn't he? He's absolutely charming.
Add Dickens to the list.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I have an observation, and I wonder what your feeling is. When I think about Poe, I do not think about the character of Dupin, I think of the story. When I think of Doyle, I think about Sherlock Holmes, but the story is secondary. Do you have a similar feeling? Is it just unique to my feeling?
I would say that, and I've put this in print, that with Sherlock Holmes, even if the story is not good, it's a nice read because of the character. And I think we read Sherlock Holmes stories now for the character. Well, most of the stories, you know, avid fans will know the outcome anyway. But you read it for the quirks and the atmosphere and the character himself. And that's why we still remember him today, I think, rather than the stories themselves. Some of them are terrible stories, some of them brilliant ones, of course, but some of them are really very, very weak. But there's always at the centre of them that mythic Sherlock Holmes.
But Holmes does things. He's a man of action as well as sort of, you know, of thought. You know, he goes places. You know, he's, you know. But whereas Dupin is like a sort of cadaver in that sense. You know, he just sort of, you know, sits in his room and, you know, he's morose and there's something sort of, you know, you can't really know him. You can't end up reading a sort of, you know, one of the stories and actually finding anything out about him.
Well, you're kind of, you're a teenager and into angst. I think Poe is quintessentially for when you're 17 or perhaps a bit younger.
It's also the jackpot as a detective writer. I don't mean that necessarily financially, but to create a character that is synonymous with its creator, so that you have, so you know, we think of Chandler, we think of Philip Marlowe immediately, and Marlowe is Chandler and vice versa, and if you can do that, the great detectives, you know, Rebus Rankin, it is done, and you can never get away from you know, Reichenbach falls or not, they'll just come back to life, and they're invulnerable.
Well, yes, it's an irony for poor Arthur Conan Doyle that we all believe in the character that he didn't believe in Sherlock Holmes, and none of us believe in what he really did believe in, which was spiritualism. So it's all gone wrong for Arthur on his 150th.
One final question.
It's literally incredible.
The second question, based on what Giles said, you mentioned Freud. Poe is full of strange, repressed sexuality. Mm. Is Doyle sexless?
No. Well, in some of his non-Sherlock Holmes stories, he's very sexy. The Parasite, for example, which is about a sort of thought vampire, it's a very, very... this was a period of time when he was going out with Jean, shall we say, but not
the act of darkness had not taken place.
indeed. All his angst is poured out into the Parasite. It's a very, very fruity novel. And I don't go completely along the same lines as Giles, thinking that Doyle was an absolute. There were some dark corners to Doyle too. I think he presented an image to the public which he wanted people to take on board. But I think there were things about him. I mean, if you read his autobiography, he just happens to say about his second wife, and then a few years later, I married a lady who was a friend of the family or something. Mm. There's no this passionate 10-year romance. No mention of it at all.
We just need to be open about that. We're not all flaunting our past, are we? Yeah. But it was a perfect gentleman. He wouldn't betray his second wife or indeed the memory of his first. He was an absolute.
ladies and gentlemen, on that irate note, I would like you to put your hands together, please, for this wonderful panel.